From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Folsom, California.
Noe Valley.
Village in the Park in Daly City.
Potrero Hill.
Glen Park.
South Beach.
I live in Bernal Heights.
Coming up, we find out how a small but growing group of biohackers are trying to police themselves.
In terms of the actual work of the Glowing Plant Project, it's not been deemed to be legal, but it's not deemed to be illegal either.
Then we explore our perceptions of what's normal.
Talking about the changing face of what is normal, there's a recognition that normal is actually a cultural idea and that it's all ever shifting.
And we visit Fifth and Market in San Francisco, where the chess obsessed have been gathering for over 30 years.
Chess is something that not only affluent, educated people play, but everyone play.
Question your assumptions today on Cross Currents. California is famous for its garage scientists. Hewlett and Packard, Steve Jobs, Dr. Emmett Brown. You know, this guy.
Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads.
You don't need to go back to the future to find scientists hacking about. You can find them working in DIY labs right now, right here in the Bay Area. Places where citizen scientists build robots and print live cells from 3D printers. Collective membership dues make the fancy lab equipment affordable, and that's the goal. Make science more accessible and less intimidating. Recently, four scientists at one of the first DIY labs, called BioCurious in Sunnyvale, well, they began experimenting with making glowing seeds. But they needed money, so instead of keeping the seeds for themselves, they decided to promise them to anyone who backed their project on Kickstarter.
What if we used trees to light our streets instead of electric street lamps? Back the project today and be one of the first to get a glowing plant.
After 8 weeks, the project had more than 8,000 backers, all expecting these seemingly magical seeds. And all those backers caused a backlash from people worried that distributing the seeds could have unintended and dangerous consequences for ecosystems around the world. KALW's Holly J. McDeed has the story.
The Container Lab, parked in San Francisco's Dog Patch District, was once an actual shipping container. These days, though, it's a molecular biology lab, which suits Kyle Taylor just fine.
Nice benches, some cabinet space, a chemical hood, and then some of the basics for molecular biology, like a PCR machine, things like that.
Taylor's part of a growing movement of scientists who identify with what's called DIY bio. That's do-it-yourself biology.
If you're passionate about plant biology, and if you choose to go into the industry, there are kind of few options that are typically limited to larger multinational corporations.
Taylor doesn't like those options, so he prefers to work outside universities and institutions.
There's something about the Bay Area that kind of makes you want to strike out on your own and kind of test the waters and kind of see if you can't maybe try to change things for the better.
Before he started here, Taylor worked at a much larger DIY biolab called BioCurious. He was interested in plants and soon gravitated to a group of plant enthusiasts studying bioluminescence. They wanted to see what they could make glow.
People have been fascinated with glowing things and glowing plants for a very long time. The first people to actually kind of work on making glowing plants were in the 80s. They took the firefly genes, basically, and put them into a tobacco plant.
Someday, Taylor wants glowing plants to replace street lamps. But for now, he just wants people to be less intimidated by genetic engineering. And he says a glowing plant is a good place to start. It's an idea people can easily wrap their minds around and get excited about.
We've got a few little Arabidopsis plants growing to make sure that they are all happy in the back here.
Taylor walks me to the back of the shipping container, where he keeps the small, wiry plant he hopes to make glow. It's called an Arabidopsis.
It's definitely not like a tulip or a rose or even a redwood tree, but it's a little plant that has its own unique little charms.
Taylor still remembers the first time he inserted gene fluorescent protein into bacteria back in high school. He wants others to experience that same thrilling power.
If I can help in some small way create that seminal moment by having someone somewhere holding a glowing plant and in the dark kind of seeing it glow, I think that's important and worth trying to find a way of releasing these seeds responsibly and safely.
But to make a glowing plant, Taylor needed money. So when he was still at BioCurious, he and his colleagues started a Kickstarter campaign and promised each backer a glowing seed of their own. For Taylor, that was the end of the line. The joy of holding a glowing seed is a reward in itself. But the project raised close to $500,000. Which made it about more than joy.
In general, we don't really know what's going to happen.
The glowing plant team still hasn't produced a single glowing seed. Yet it's already generated fierce controversy at BioCurious. Christina Hathaway is the lab's executive director.
Do we know what's going to happen when that Arabidopsis is placed in a variety of settings locally? In the gardens, front lawns, windowsills, pots, wherever it is that it's grown from the people that it's sent to. No, we really don't. And that's the part where I think people get worried and they get alarmed because we don't really know.
Hathaway thinks the glowing plant has cast a shadow on DIY Bio by linking the movement to a potentially risky project. She worries this will increase federal regulation.
DIY Bio in general is not an overly regulated field, which is a good thing. We try to use our powers for good, you know, in the aggregate. And what does that mean? It means don't just genetically engineer something and then just wildly release it without thinking about what the consequences might be.
This is why Kyle Taylor is working in a shipping container. The controversy got so big that he left BioCurious. Technically, though, he hasn't done anything wrong. Genetically modifying an Arabidopsis plant is completely legal. Authority to ban the plant would fall to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which oversees the release of genetically engineered plants. But
it's not a food.
That's Susan Hake. She's the director at the USDA Gene Expression Center in Berkeley. She says that if the plant were edible, it would need to be regulated. And if it were an invasive weed, it would need to be regulated too.
Those are all considerations. What can it cross with? Is it eaten? And would you be creating superweeds?
But Hake says, as long as no one's eating the glowing plant, there are no permits needed and no harm done.
Arabidopsis is a weed and it does pretty well in the wild as it is. They're self-pollinating, which means that they don't outcross. And I don't think that either the luciferase or the fluorescent proteins gives it any kind of advantage. It's not going to make it happier or sadder in the wild.
But to others, this isn't an issue of whether or not any one glowing plant is safe. It's about regulating all GMOs. In response to the glowing plant Kickstarter campaign, human rights organization ETC and environmental group Friends of the Earth wrote Kickstarter a letter.
We are writing to express our concern about the listing of a project on Kickstarter that will likely result in widespread, random, and uncontrolled release of bioengineered seeds and plants produced through the controversial and risky techniques of synthetic biology.
Kyle Taylor has invited his backers to be a part of the conversation and to ask questions about the project's safety. And he hopes other scientists will build on their work.
The constructs that we use, the DNA sequences that we use to make the glowing plant, we want those to be open source and available to other DIY bio enthusiasts or other labs.
In the wake of the controversy, Kickstarter now bans rewarding backers with genetically modified plants. But the glowing plant project is allowed to proceed, which means more than 8,000 people will get their hands on glowing seeds in less than a year. For Taylor, that's what the project is all about, reminding people that you don't need to work for a private corporation or university to play around with science, or on a more grand scale, to change the world.
It's 2013, right? Weren't we promised like flying cars and colonies on the moon and like, you know, the future's now, right? With this kind of the recent economic recession, all of the talk about climate change, it seems to get this general impression that there's this bleak future, right? And to me, this seems to be a way of kind of taking back that narrative a little bit and saying, no, look, there's still a lot to be hopeful about the future. And at the risk of making a horrible, horrible, horrible pun, the future is brighter than people think.
One other glowing project cropped up on Kickstarter before the ban. This one involves growing and tending to single-celled organisms called dinoflagellates. So even if we don't get glowing plants, we might get glowing single-celled house pets. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
What do you think about DIY science? Should anyone be able to experiment with plant and animal DNA? Or should there be more regulation? Leave your thoughts on our feedback line at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106.
Jack climbed a beanstalk to heaven. Oh, but I got there on the night you said you cared. Jack found a giant in heaven. Finally, as for me, I found heaven helped me. Sweetheart angel, heaven, can't you see that you mean all of that to me? Oh, Jack climbed the beanstalk.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. Glowing seeds might seem abnormal to us today, but really, our concept of normal is always shifting. And that's the subject of an exhibit at San Francisco's Exploratorium, particularly how the idea of normal aligns with mental health. It was only about 60 years ago that psychiatric professionals decided to classify mental disorders with the publication of the first Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. The definitions therein are regularly reevaluated, and today, over a quarter of the adult U.S. population suffers from a diagnosable mental disorder. KALW's Angela Penny went to the Exploratorium to speak with the curator of the exhibit, The Changing Face of Normal, Mental Health.
Frank C. was institutionalized in 1945 because he was considered mentally ill.
He's the guy that we theorize probably was gay and was really having a hard time with it.
This is museum curator Pamela Winfrey.
He went into a diner and he was served on a chipped plate. And he was so upset, he took it personally, that he came outside and he started kicking a garbage can down the road. And people got him, and he never really got out of a variety. He went from this hospital to a military hospital, but he never really got out.
There's a reason we know about Frank C. His suitcase and 466 others were discovered in the attic of the Willard Psychiatric Center in upstate New York when the building was destroyed in 1995. Now, it's part of an exhibit at the Exploratorium called The Changing Face of Normal, Mental Health. Winfrey describes some of his belongings.
He has a lot of photographs. He has a lot of neckties. He has his military uniform. I think he was a pretty snappy dresser.
Frank C. lived at the hospital from 1945 through 1949. His official diagnosis at the time was dementia praecox.
Dementia praecox, that was a huge umbrella for the language of the time. Lots and lots of conditions were sort of poured through that idea.
And his doctors suspected latent homosexual desires. Winfrey says his situation was a product of the times he grew up in. Things would be very different if he were born decades later.
In San Francisco, he would have had a huge community, and he would have been like, he would have understood that he was part of a place where he is normal. I think it was 1972 where they took out homosexuality from the DSM.
The DSM is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. Its fifth edition was published in May. When the first edition was made,
they had no language. If you get the language,
Then you can also get the statistics and the data behind the language. You can say, well, you know, like 50% of the guys who are coming back from World War II have, at the, you know, what we would say is PTSD, for example. And the thing about the DSM is that it's a really important book, because if you're not listed in here and you have a condition, you can't get it covered by insurance.
But these issues don't touch everyone's lives evenly and are often taboo. So, in putting together this exhibit, Winfrey was partially motivated by a desire to humanize the mental health community.
You walk through and you see the artifacts. You see these very, very basic objects. And I think the fact that they're just so everyday, first of all, sort of erases that wall between us and them.
And we didn't know about dosages, and we didn't know about the science.
The exhibit also includes audio stations with interviews between psychiatrist Karen Miller and some of the original caretakers from Willard, who were there during the introduction of tranquilizers in the late 1950s.
The trouble with tranquilizers, they quieted them down, but then they quieted them down too much.
Yeah.
And then they'd sit around and drool and be in a coma-like, and that was
yeah,
bad.
There are also videos of people from today's mental health community.
Although the people around me thought I had a breakdown, for me it was a breakout. It was the first day.
Sally Zinman, who was had a very bad and brutal experience in the 70s, has turned this, she's an activist, and she's turned this into her career. She doesn't feel like anybody should ever be labeled.
Winfrey says this exhibit is a new approach for the Exploratorium, and the response has been overwhelmingly positive.
It's all about trying to get to be in somebody else's shoes. What would it be like if you had been at the turn of the century? What would it be like if you were uncomfortable with the idea that you might be gay in a time when that was not accepted? What would it be like if you're hearing voices then as opposed to now?
Winfrey hopes visitors will reflect on these questions and realize that even today, what we consider normal can change. For Cross Currents, I'm Angela Penny.
The changing face of normal mental health will be at the Exploratorium through April 2014. For more details, visit kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. It's not often that a 93-year-old, a trapeze artist, a kid from the Sunnydale Projects, and a DJ from a gentleman's club can find something in common. But if you've ever been to Fifth and Market in downtown San Francisco, you know that the intersection is one place where this was possible. That's where people of all walks of life have been playing chess since the 1980s. But last week, the San Francisco Police Department confiscated chairs, chessboards, and game pieces from the area and shut down all competition. According to the police and local business owners, the chess playing wasn't a problem, but it attracted problematic behaviors like illicit drug use, illegal street barbecues, gambling, and other crime. So for now, the cops are holding the street chess scene in check. Whether or not that's checkmate, it's still to be determined. In this story from our archives, reporter Sam Harnett paid a visit to the mid-market chess scene and challenged the masters to a game.
There are 10 chess games running out here on the corner of Market Street and Mason, and it doesn't take a chess master to see who the regulars are.
But this way you kind of like put your bishop out of the game, and then plus you lock in your other bishop.
Yeah, it's dumb.
This way you can just...
I'm watching a Latino guy in a wheelchair destroy a college kid. He's showing him how he's losing on the chessboard. And he's right, that blocked bishop is useless. But that's easy to say from up here. When you're sitting down, it's a whole nother chess game. The competition is stiff. The 5-minute speed format is unforgiving, and the game completely absorbing. That's what draws people out here to play, but that's not all they do. They also eat, smoke, socialize, and gamble.
You don't want to play me? I don't know. Let me...
Play for a dollar or something.
All right. Sure.
I've been spotted, or fished, as they like to say out here. It's normally $5 a game, but the guy in the wheelchair can see I'm an easy catch, so he reels me in for a dollar game. Before I can sit down, I have to pay John Powell. He's in charge out here.
So each individual player, they give me $1 for 1 hour of time. However many games you can get in during that hour, that's between you.
Powell learned how to play chess hanging around these tables. Now he comes every day to make a living.
Well, yeah, I do sustain myself in modest, very modest means, you know, because right now chess is a luxury.
There's nothing luxurious about these games. The tables and plastic chairs are worn, the stretch of street is dominated by empty storefronts and strip clubs, and the players range from quirky to ragtag. But even so, people of all kinds come to play chess here.
Because I've had affluent people from Pacific Heights sit down and play out here for hours. And then I've had people from Sunnydale Projects or people from the Tenderloin.
I'm about to join that melting pot. I give Powell a dollar, and he gives me a warning. Apparently, my opponent is one of the strongest players on the street. His name is Jorge Lopez.
Yeah. I've seen him run something that he calls a Great Wall of China. Where it's just basically the first seven or eight moves is nothing but pawns.
To win out here, I'll have to contend with the Great Wall of China, not to mention everything else happening on the street. But as soon as I start playing, I get sucked in. Even though it's pretty clear, I don't stand a chance.
No, but remember the night was here at the last one. From here, you're not going to be able to cover.
No,
now
dead.
You're out.
I'm dead.
Yeah, now there's nothing you can do. Unless you can give me the queen then. But yeah.
Before I know it, we played six games, and I've lost every one. For the last hour, the only thing that has mattered in the entire world is this chessboard. That kind of focus makes real-life problems fade away, and the guys out here have seen their fair share of real-life problems. Powell says the regulars come out for a community and a game that helps them stay sane.
Chess is something that not only affluent, educated people play, but everyone play.
Street players who want to test their skills walk a few blocks down Market to 57 Post Street, the Mechanics Chess Club. Tuesday night is tournament night, and when I arrive, club director John Donaldson is resetting a player's clock.
This is why I went to college for this. Okay, so we got 8, 9
Donaldson
minutes.
Is the John Powell of the Mechanics Club. He organizes tournaments, promotes the club, and maintains order. When the clock is set, he leads me into the tournament room. Inside, the air is filled with the smell of sweat and the nerve-rattling sound of 30 ticking game clocks. Players of all ages and backgrounds are battling in games that can last hours. Donaldson points out the strongest player in the room, a 15-year-old competing in a separate tournament for Masters. The boy is Daniel Naroditsky. He was the World Youth Chess Champion in 2007. He's not the only character playing tonight. In the center of the room, I notice the same guy who beat me on the street, Jorge Lopez. The only thing missing is his dangling cigarette.
He was like the king of fifth in Powell, and he came from over there to play in our tournament, and he's leading it now with 5-0.
Just like on the street, a diverse crowd comes to Mechanics for chess.
I think we figured like 14 different languages covered out of those 60 players, from Mongolian to Slovak to Tagalog to Armenian to Persian.
But there is a gap in diversity when it comes to gender. Carol Knopf is one of only two women competing tonight. She's a trapeze artist who started playing chess as an overworked graduate student.
So I was like late at night at home and I found chess.com on the internet and I thought, wow, I just go on and there's like an actual person on the other side somewhere in the world and you're playing with them.
Carl Wobeke says he's had a fraught relationship with the game.
My father was a sadist and he was a bad winner and I vowed to destroy him over the chessboard and that's why I got good. But it was bad motivation and that's why I dropped out.
Wobeke was the high school chess champion of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 50 years ago. Wobeke says it worries him to see kids studying the game and taking lessons at such an early age.
Enjoyment is the issue. Sometimes I get up in the middle of the game and look around, and the room is filled with unhappy faces. I mean, I don't know what the hell these people are doing here unless they have nothing else to do. Well, you know, I'm doing other things, too. I'm playing the trombone. I'm a professional astrologer. I'm, you know, meditating.
At the end of the night, a handful of people gather to watch Jorge Lopez play his final moves, as they often do on the street. Donaldson says he has a ton of respect for the street players. He's shocked when I tell him they've had to move their games from their longtime home at the 5th and Market BART station.
I notice those guys like shooting up or defecating on the street.
They just play chess, and they'll keep playing chess. Donaldson says no matter where the street players have to move, the doors to Mechanics will always be open. In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Cross Currents.
The SFPD shut down the chess games on Market Street last week. They say one way that the games could be allowed to continue is if a local business pays for a permit for game playing on the sidewalk. We'll keep you posted at KALW.org. That's all for today's edition of Cross Currents. The team includes David Boyer, Jeremy Dalmas, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Alyssa Kapnick, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Liz Pfeffer, Stephen Short, and Mary Willis. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we're listener-supported radio. The music you're hearing is by the Mobius Trio. They formed back in 2010 while the members were studying at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. You can hear what they sound like now on Saturday at the Center for New Music in San Francisco. The performance begins around 8 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Treffney.